Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. The world's first credit card, or at least the world's first widely accepted charge card, was introduced back in 1950s. It was the Diners Club, and it could initially only be used at 14 restaurants in New York. We've certainly come a long way from what laid the foundation for today's global electronic payments industry. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest decision by the Monetary Policy Committee to hold the interest rates exactly where they are. We know that this has had some implications on the performance of the rand and how markets are perhaps looking at the South African markets at the moment. We're going to dig into this in a bit more detail with the Institute for Economic Justice and see if we can make sense of the rate decision and perhaps what other decisions may have been out there. We also have a conversation with the team at Standard Bank taking a look at unlocking LNG opportunities in South Africa. That's liquefied natural gas. Opportunities that exist in South Africa and perhaps on the African continent as well. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the AGM that is set to take place next week for the Public Investment Corporation. We know that the Minister of Finance, Minister Enoch Godongwana, has called that AGM to hopefully address the concerns that have been plaguing the Public Investment Corporation of late. We're going to see if we can make sense of that and get some thoughts ahead of that meeting. That meeting obviously set to take place early next week, the 27th of July, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll see what to look forward to around that and perhaps what that could do for markets, or rather for the Public Investment Corporation. Then we have a conversation taking a look at balancing the grid stability requirements with the coal retirement plans that we have. The Chief Executive Officer of Eskom, Dan Marokane, recently commented that we need to be balancing how it is that we decommission our coal-fired power stations in an effort to ensure that we maintain grid stability, especially with what we have come from as a country. We don't want to go back to the days of load shedding. So we're going to look at that with power and energy expert Professor Vali Pariachi to see if we can make sense of how it is that we can achieve that balance. As always, it's Thursday. We wrap up the show with a small business conversation. This week, we're speaking to the founder and CEO of Bro Cabs, getting to know that business a little bit better.
The Day's Markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by Sanlam Private Wealth's Senior Portfolio Manager, Nick Kunz, to take a look at markets and see what we make of them. Nicholas, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. What happened?
Evening, Jimmy.
Everything's red.
Trying to make sense of the markets. Oh, goodness. Where do you want to start? I mean, first and foremost, obviously the Reserve Bank decision, but we can chat about that in a second. But I mean, coming into today, a very risk-off day. A lot of that driven by the news out of the US last night with Google and how much of free cash flow they are now sucking up on capex, and of course on top of that, the geopolitics in the Middle East and an oil price staggeringly above $100 a barrel. Now put that all together, it's a very red day on the JSE.
I don't even know where this conversation goes because you and I ordinarily have some level of optimism to look forward to. Mm-hmm. The rand is down. You touched on the fact that the oil price is back above $100, which means we're going to be under further pressure from an inflation perspective, which doesn't bode well for the current situation that led to the rand being down today. Where do we find solace? Give me something, Nick.
Let's start with the good governor. I mean, giving us a little bit of a breather at the Saab today. I mean, holding rates at 7%. I mean, that decision, let's be honest, it caught everyone. That wasn't the consensus call. Just look at the rand. The rand blew out over 2% at the back. So no one was positioned for a rate hold, certainly. But that's good news for us. I mean, and quite frankly, even though it was a bit of a MPC vote split at 4-2, you know, hold versus a hike. I think it was the right decision, Jimmy. I mean, he's referred to, you know, exactly what's happening with the oil price. I mean, majority of inflation is coming from that imported oil. The rest of the market is kind of flat to going nowhere. So yeah, I mean, it is. I guess you can have a little bit of a silver lining, but I mean, I think it's, you know, it's just basically a hold until we know what's happening. It's just too much uncertainty in the market right now.
Nick, we saw that sell-off be widespread across the equity markets. We know that financial stocks can be kind of a good barometer of what markets might be thinking, especially around the investor confidence levels of South Africa. And we saw the Rand and those stocks both selling off. I think the 2% I, for one, wasn't expecting against the US dollar, and the fact that we shot all the way back above 19 Rand against the euro. We were doing so well maintaining things. Any thoughts around perhaps whether or not the decision could have been swung the other way and markets would have been happier with that?
It's so difficult to tell. I mean, I was under the impression. I thought we might even, there might be even a hawkish hint, you know, coming in with a 0.25% rise, maybe hinting more rises to come, because, I mean, that inflation, the print that came out for the month of June, that CPI at 5%, I mean, I thought that would spook the living daylights out of our MPC. I mean, they're notoriously hawkish at the best of times. So, I don't know, I guess. The big move in the Rand also, I mean, the market's also a little bit, not quite sure why they went on hold now. They did point out the forward guidance, you know, they expect headline inflation to sit above 4%, you know, that's still well above the 3%. I guess to a certain extent, you know, we are reliant on what happens outside of our borders. So maybe that's the reason why. Would there have been a different outcome? I'm not really sure. Look, we've still in South Africa, still got a little bit of a cushion with our real rates. Yes, inflation is still high, but that 10-year bond is still, you know, 3-4 basis points, 3-4% above it. So we've still got real yields around about 3%. So we've still got a little bit of a cushion for now anyway. But yeah, it's tricky, Jimmy. It's really not quite sure how this plays out at the moment.
Nick, let's look at US markets. US earnings season, numbers are being reported there. The NASDAQ down as well from that perspective. European markets traded through the day, that there weren't too many surprises from that perspective. But the big thing, the NASDAQ down more than 2%. The S&P down more than 1%. The Dow Jones down more than 1%. We did see a sell-off in European markets as well, so they weren't exempt from this. Is this the repercussions, or perhaps the consequences, of the fact that the oil price is back above $100 a barrel?
Definitely. I mean, take it on its own, you'd have to say oil at 100 is spooking the market. It is a risk-off day, and you can see that across most asset classes. But it also needs to be looked, I think, Jimmy, in a bit of a wider lens, because after the close last night in the US, we had two of the biggest names in tech reporting, you know, that magnificent seven, as they call them. This was two of that seven. I mean, Google is what everyone's talking about, or Alphabet, as it trades as Lister's name. I mean, for the first time since that stock was listed on the NASDAQ, and we're talking decades ago, it's actually burned cash. I mean, $6 billion of negative free cash flow, first time ever. And that's because of all the spending on the AI infrastructure. I mean, it's faster than even those enormous ad and cloud businesses can fund it. I mean, it's actually quite a staggering turnaround. So that's obviously spooked. It's been a while coming. You know, last couple of weeks there's been huge concerns about this CapEx, and now we're seeing it real time. And what does it actually mean? I mean, it's the likes of a Google can actually have a negative cash flow. It's extraordinary. And then the second big story was obviously Tesla. I mean, it's a little bit more old-fashioned. I mean, it still sells electric cars, but it sold more cars than ever, but it made far less profit because that EV tax credit's gone. So two sort of biggish names, you know, sort of poster childs for that Magnificent Seven, putting spookiness. And then again, Jimmy, you put that on top of all that 100 and a risk-off sort of day. I mean, we really didn't stand a chance today.
Clearly, the markets have had a rough day, and it seems as though we could be in for a rough end to this week. We're going to have to leave this conversation on that note, but I'm certainly going to catch up with Nicholas in the near future, because I want to get his thoughts around if it is the end of the AI bubble and these are the early signs. How do we prepare for that? But that's definitely a conversation for another day. For now, we'll leave this one on this note. Senior Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, joining us to take a look at markets and try and make sense of the day that was.
Hi, I need finance to transport crops.
You need to get it to the right ports. With a buyer lined up across the ocean, and assurance you'll get paid, plus funding for next season.
Well, I was thinking basic asset finance, but financial solutions...
that make global trade happen.
Is what I should be thinking.
At Nedbank, we see more than farming. From agriculture production loans to global trade expertise, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, of course, that all-important interest rate decision was delivered by the Governor of the Central Bank of South Africa earlier today. We know that the interest rates have been held as they are. We're going to be looking into this in a bit more detail and trying to see whether or not this decision was the best decision, or perhaps whether or not there were some other factors that could have influenced this decision in any particular direction. I'm joined on the line by the senior researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice, Dr. Mzwanele Ntwanti, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Doc, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts on the rates decision, it clearly caught the market by surprise, and I suppose it may have caught many investors and many economists by surprise, but your thoughts on the decision itself?
Thank you so much, Jimmy, and good evening to you and the listeners. Certainly, I mean, I think it caught many of us by surprise, especially when those inflation numbers came in yesterday. It sort of became quite clear that we would then have an increase in the interest rates, given the fact that inflation pressures are quite much rising in that sense. But I think obviously there are a number of factors that might have influenced the interest rate hold. And I think one of those factors might be because that they were a bit in a hurry to have done so in May. So that for me is an admission that maybe they acted quite too fast in May, and that now they are needing to practice patience. Second reason could, of course, be the fact that many central banks around the world are also practicing patience. We've seen, for instance, today that the European Central Bank also held its interest rates. We've seen the US is also doing similarly. Bank of Indonesia yesterday did the same. So we are seeing this sort of being patient, so to speak, with the current times and just sort of playing it out. And I think thirdly, and hopefully this would be the real reason, it's actually the acknowledgement that this inflation is being driven by supply side factors in our case, and globally, obviously, the fuel price because of the ongoing war, but locally we have the issues with municipalities raising tariffs on refuse, electricity, water, etc. So if you look at the numbers, for instance, from States SA yesterday, if you remove those two, the fuel as well as the administered prices, then inflation is sitting at around 3.4%. So the bank would have been happy with that, and there would have been no reason to act.
Mzwanele, why then did the market punish the central bank for that decision? I'm looking at the rand. It lost significant ground against all of the major currencies. There was a massive sell-off in equity markets. I just discussed that with Nick Kunz of Sanlam Private Wealth. Why then, if we're taking a measured approach, which is very consistent with the central bank, did this decision spook the market so much?
I think one of those reasons obviously would speak to credibility and anchoring of expectations. And those people would have been held in certain stocks or assets, etc. And they would have been really looking to cash out. And I think we also have to obviously look at the profit margins in some of the financial institutions and the liquid assets, and how then people have been trading this and benefiting quite a lot as a result of the ongoing war. So I think obviously then that was a shock. I think secondly, because we know our central bank to be quite conservative, or to, so to speak, quite strict on inflation. So this all definitely then would come by surprise, going against our predictions in the markets in general, and with many economists. So that I think would be the primary two reasons.
Mzwanele, this potentially could be the first time we've seen our central bank not be as hawkish as what the market has anticipated or expected them to be. And I see just before we started this conversation, the team at the IEJ issued a statement around perhaps this could be the turnaround in monetary policy that we see from the central bank. Now, I want to look at that, and I want to look at perhaps what that would look like, because a turnaround in monetary policy is significantly different from a single rate decision. Why would the turnaround conversation start to come up here?
I think that's important. And I think, one, it is the global factors and headwinds, like I was indicating. I mean, the Fed this year has sort of said they're not looking at any increases, you know. And like I was illustrating, that most big central banks are practicing caution. So if that's just the general case around the central banks around the world, then it would begin the turnaround in saying that there is an admission amongst central bankers that interest rates and monetary policy is not sufficient to deal with the economic-wide challenges. For instance, we know the economic costs of relatively higher interest rates, lower employment, lower growth output, lower manufacturing, lower investment, high credit for households, etc. So that would be an admission, you know, to say that households have been squeezed quite a lot. For instance, if you listen to our governor, he's beginning to understand and talk about this idea of structural reforms and the need for the municipalities. It's become clear that they are crucial in terms of growth and employment and investment. And therefore, that means that we're going to need now a whole of government and a whole of economy approach, and that the central banks are not going to remain to be that holy cow that would be able to stabilize everything. I think that would also be an admission, and that's completely fine. You know, it's okay that there is that admission. Then we would then be moving away from monetary dominance, that every problem that we have can possibly be resolved by a change in the interest rate, but to then begin to have a broader economic conversation about how we adopt a whole of economy and a whole of government approach.
So before I let you go, I want to take a look at the implications this has on the South African rand. That could mean short-term pain for the South African rand. It could mean short-term pain for markets, as global markets then potentially need to realign how it is that they view South Africa. But could this potentially be in the long-term interest of South Africa's economy if we are to have a more flexible monetary policy, or perhaps some of the decisions be more aligned with our local economy as opposed to international markets?
I didn't hear what you said, Jimmy, about the exchange rate.
Sorry. The short-term pain that we could potentially be seeing on the rand and on other equity markets, that could be a short-term sacrifice in the pursuit of longer-term benefits for the South African economy. Is that potentially worth taking the risk at this stage and saying perhaps monetary policy does need to be re-looked at if that could be a catalyst for a different kind of South Africa?
Yes, I mean, one exchange rate has been doing well, I think, for the last year or so. It's really been showing resilience. In fact, it has also contributed to some of the growth that we see in terms of the net exports. So that has been attributed to a sort of a resilient exchange rate. So I mean, again, because you have small economies like South Africa, in a way, looking at what the euro, the dollar do, if those economies are not moving as well, then you don't necessarily have a hedging system for South Africans to keep high interest rates in that sense, because, you know, investments would not necessarily yield a higher return. So this, I think, insofar as we look at that, I don't think the exchange rate itself is a bigger issue. I think maybe capital movements for different reasons, you know, profit shifting and volatilities and capital management, etc., could be a different conversation. But I think that this is certainly would be a better path for our monetary policy than keeping the high interest rates at the cost of price stability. Because I think that is, if indeed we're moving that direction, then we would be moving into a correct direction, because we would be acknowledging that what we have been doing really to employment as well as output, growth and investment in this country has been disastrous. And that being more flexible and looking at a broader policy toolkit would then begin to see growth in our economy.
A broader policy toolkit does also mean that the central bank is not the only party responsible for what has been happening, if that is the conversation that is to be had. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that particular note. The senior researcher for the Institute of Economic Justice, Dr. Mzwanele Ntwanti, joining us to take a look at markets, the interest rate decision that was tabled today by the central bank, a decision to leave interest rates unchanged, and the impact that could have on South Africa's monetary policy.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Africa. If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzi Leramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, if you've been keeping up with the events unfolding at the Public Investment Corporation, you'll know that we've seen even more resignations from the board or board members of the Public Investment Corporation. And these resignations have sparked concern, so much so that the Minister of Finance, Minister Enoch Godongwana, will be calling an AGM next week on Monday, the 27th of July, to address the concerns around the Public Investment Corporation. We're going to see if we can make sense of that, as well as some of the other factors that have been unfolding in a bit more detail. I'm joined on the line by by the director at the Center for Public Policy and African Studies at the University of Johannesburg, Prof Busani Ngaweni, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Prof, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Definitely not an ideal situation that the Public Investment Corporation finds itself in, with a board that has all but collapsed at this point, with a chief executive officer that has been suspended. We've been keeping an eye on this for quite some time. From your perspective, your insights around how it is that we got to this particular point in the case of the PIC?
Thank you, Jimmy. Good evening to you and good evening to the listeners. This is a very unfortunate situation, Jimmy, for several reasons. One is that the size of the assets that the PIC holds in the form of the pension funds of public servants that it invests, it is so big that you don't expect that we could have such fights within the board and with the executive that put at risk the ability of the organization to safeguard these investments. It is too big in the South African economy, given the type of investment that the PIC can make. This really is a problem for the whole economy, not just for those who have got pensions that have been invested there. And I say this because when you have so many leaks and stories in the public domain and in social media about squabbles between directors and both non-executive as well as executive directors, then it means that there is indeed a problem. The PIC, Jimmy, is not a small SOE of some municipality somewhere in an obscure region of the Republic. It is a very important one. We've got firms who are doing asset management, which depends on the PIC for their survival. We've got pensioners who hope that this money is being invested will accrue real interest in order to grow and safeguard their pensions. So this is just too big to fail.
It definitely is too big to fail, Prof. I want to look ahead to next week's AGM meeting. What needs to be done? What conversations need to be had around the Public Investment Corporation? Because aside from the obvious fact around it being too big to fail, as you mentioned, 3.6 trillion rands in assets, something else that you touched on, certainly is something that we need to be very careful as to how it is that we manage those or that those funds are administered on behalf of organizations like the Government Employees Pension Fund. So going into next week's meeting, what important conversations need to be had here?
That meeting must be guided by few pieces of legislation. For an example, Section 76 of the Companies Act requires that every director must act in good faith and for a proper purpose. Therefore, the question is, in all decisions made by the board up to so far, were they made in good faith and for proper purpose? It appears from some of the news that we have been reading and hearing that there might be a possibility of a doubt. And if that doubt does exist, it means that Section 76(3) of the Companies Act might have been breached. It further says that directors must act in the best interest of the company, and they must act with a degree of care, skill, and diligence that may reasonably be expected of a person serving as a non-executive director. So the question is, of all decisions made, were these consistent with the provision of the company? The other document which is very crucial here, Jimmy, is the Memorandum of Incorporation, or MOI, of the PIC, because it says the management and control of the company vests with the board as a whole, not just individual. And so when the minister is calling the meeting we called in the special AGM, he would be putting to the test this particular section of the MOI, to the extent that he will further be asking, has the board failed to perform its duties to the company as contemplated in the MOI as well as in the Companies Act? Of course, there's also the PFMA and several others that makes it very explicit in terms of what is expected of people serving as governors, including Section 50 of the PFMA, which is very explicit in terms of what is expected of them as the governors of the institution. So what we should expect, therefore, is that those who remain, because it's about five or four, give or take, who remain out of the full complement, will then be having to justify that the five or four of us who remain we remain competent to exercise fiduciary duty to this organization, all the reports that have been made regardless. And you must remember, the CEO is also a director, federally suspended, together with the CIO. So there is a crisis, however, where you look at it, and if you were to put this to the test using the provisions of the law that I have quoted, including the whistleblower framework of this very same organization, you'll see that the board will have some questions to answer.
Mm-hmm. Prof, it goes beyond the board at this stage because, as you rightly mentioned, the CEO has a different set of questions to answer for. The chief investment officer was the first to part ways with the PIC earlier. All of these events have unfolded in less than 150 days, and that, I suppose, is a concerning factor of its own. In terms of the ongoing operations of the business, we know that last week, almost this time last week around Friday, the chairman of the board, who also the deputy minister of finance, Dr. Masondo, held a town hall with PIC employees to reassure them that everything was being handled and being taken care of. If we are to go from that conversation to perhaps where we find ourselves here and the other questions that exist beyond the board's governance capabilities, how do we deal with the internal conversations, because they affect the daily operations of the business?
Oh, most certainly. The boardroom politics has got a major impact in the organization, from the topmost official who remains all the way down to the receptionist, because every time there are people coming in and out of the organization, the receptionist would be, you know, worried and thinking, what the hell is going on now? Is this investigators? Is it the police? So it has a major impact. It has a major impact because there are also pending decisions, remember. Some of them ought to have been rectified by the board. And some of these are very critical investment decisions where people have either, you know, borrowed money or whatever the case might be. It means those transactions will now be in abeyance. And even if you were to appoint a new board, it may be interim or not, it will take time before these things come back into the table. So this does not just affect employees, senior and junior. It also affects several stakeholders outside who expect the thing that must be made by the board itself. But this tells us something, which we should need to look at. You know, and I'm making this on a lighter note, of course, that there would be an SOE in a small municipality somewhere that will experience the same. We should expect, as members of the public, from a governance point of view, that organizations as big as the PIC must have sufficient anticipatory and risk management capacity such that it must be able to see very far where a small entity in the municipality cannot be able to see. Because their capability to anticipate, to manage the risk, will safeguard or shield the organization under conditions like these ones, where you know that if there were payments to be made, those payments will still be made as they were supposed to be made because they were approved through the due process. Where you know what then happens in the investments that were supposed to be approved by, say, a majority of board members under these conditions, because it is not untenable that the board can meet in its current form and make some investment decisions currently. And so the challenge then into the future that as the public should be challenged the states to do is to build anticipatory and risk management capabilities to be able to build those shock absorbers that will sustain organizations in times like these ones, because it is not viable. One cannot.
We definitely need to have a resolution towards the Public Investment Corporation's governance concerns, and this is what we hope is achieved by the AGM that's been called by the minister. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Professor Busani Ngaweni, the director for the director at the Center for Public Policy and African Studies at the University of Johannesburg, joining us to share his thoughts around the governance concerns at the Public Investment Corporation.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
I'm Nobukhanya Mtambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Chief Executive Officer at Eskom has come out with comments recently around grid stability and the importance of maintaining grid stability as we look to decommission our coal-fired power plants. We're going to be exploring this in a bit more detail with power and energy expert Professor Vali Pariachi, who joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of this. Prof Pariachi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The retirement of coal-fired power plants has taken many different shapes in terms of conversation. We at one point said as part of our Just Energy Transition initiatives, this is something we were going to do expeditiously. Now we're scaling back on that. We've heard so many different conversations around this. How do we make sense of where we stand at the moment?
Good evening, Jimmy, to you and your listeners, and I'm glad to be back on your show. Yes, I'm aware of those conversations, and maybe just as a disclaimer, I won't be talking on behalf of Eskom, but I do come from Eskom, and I have about many decades of experience in the sector, power and energy sector, so I'll give you my experience view on this. Yes, there have been many conversations, but suffice to say that all of these conversations, and I do come from generation, it has to be underpinned by energy security. And energy security is further, if I distill it, is underpinned by a stable grid. And when I talk about grid, I talk about generation, transmission, distribution. And pursuant to ensuring a stable grid, which we had for many, many decades, with close to 100 years, was coal-fired power stations. And not getting too much of detail, coal-fired coal is part of what we call a dispatchable technology, together with gas, nuclear, and hydro. And renewables is not a dispatchable technology. It's intermittent, but always on. So given that situation, coal-fired stations, as I alluded to, contribute to a stable grid. Now, there's been talk of decommissioning it because they've come, most of them have come to the end of their lives. But if you decommission it, you've got to replace it with equivalent technologies. At the moment, we don't have that. We're heading towards a gas cliff. Renewables is not completely reliable compared to coal. So in a nutshell, let me make a final point. We need to extend some of these coal-fired power stations. At the moment, I think we're talking about eight or nine, and that will be done in a responsible manner, taking into consideration emission control, etc. To me.
Prof Pariachi, if we look at the Just Energy Transition initiatives and ambitions that we have as a country, we know that the extended use of coal has been something that has been quite contentious in that respect especially. And we also know that from a reserve perspective, South Africa holds by a significant margin the largest amount of proven coal reserves on the African continent. And we know that it's been used to effectively allow us to be able to industrialize our economy to this extent. If we are to have the conversation, does the conversation then shift from transitioning away from coal entirely and perhaps into incorporating what we have as existing fleet whilst incorporating new fleet? Is that how we maintain and manage our grid stability issues?
I think it's a combination of all of those. I mean, that conversation started South Africa from COP 27-28 is committed to sustainability, achieving sustainability net zero 2050 targets. So that's quite clear in the conversation. But I go back to what I've alluded to earlier in my conversation, and this is based on science and engineering. Without energy security, which is paramount for all countries, not only South Africa, globally, it would be extremely difficult to pursue decarbonization. Because if you do that very simply, you will take decisions that will compromise energy security. And I'm talking from experience. And Eskom, to give you further detail, as decoupled the decommissioning of power stations from the achievement of net zero targets. In other words, the decision making will not be clouded by if we had to have them under one roof. So just to summarize, yes, South Africa is committed. We will transition to a renewable energy mix, and it shouldn't be a case of renewables versus dispatchables. It has to be a combination of both. We do support renewables, but here I talk as an engineer, as an experienced generation engineer. You cannot sacrifice and compromise the integrity of the grid in lieu of decarbonization. And that was also made clear by the Eskom Group CEO yesterday.
We cannot sacrifice the integrity of our grid in an effort to decarbonize, especially given the situation, the precarious position South Africa finds itself in. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Prof. Vali Pariachi, power and energy expert, joining us to take a look at the sentiments echoed by the Chief Executive Officer of Eskom around balancing grid stability with retirement of coal plants.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. Whilst we're having conversations of energy, we're going to be taking a look at the world of liquefied natural gas and what opportunities lie in that respect. For that conversation, I'm joined on the line by the gas sector lead at the Standard Bank Group, Paul Erdi-Taylor, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Paul, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Looking at the energy mix that South Africa finds itself confronted with, but also the African continent, how important and how strategic a role does LNG then play in not just our own energy ambitions, but also the energy market broadly?
From an SA perspective, it can be very interesting. SA is pretty unique. The world has 25% gas as a source of primary energy. South Africa has 3%. The world has 22% gas to power, South Africa has 0%. So there's clearly a big gap in the market from a South African perspective. From an African continent perspective, multiple countries already produce LNG. More of those countries will increase, especially Mozambique, but also markets like Senegal, Mauritania, and so on.
Paul, you mentioned Mozambique, and I just thought back to the Mozambique gas pipeline that was shut down recently, or that intends to, I suppose we're in the process of decommissioning that that pipeline coming through into South Africa. South Africa's been having conversations around a gas cliff that's been confronting us for quite a number of years. That clearly means then that we have a problem where it relates to liquefied natural gas. We know that we've recently looked to commission or to approve a new power plant for liquefied natural gas in Richards Bay. I want to get your thoughts now around perhaps how it is that all of these factors, especially from an infrastructure perspective, start to come together for the LNG picture in South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Romco line has supplied the country very well for over 20 years. The supply from Mozambique is organically declining. It's entirely normal. all gas fields reduce over time. So the argument that's been made is there's an awful lot of gas around the world. When you have gas in big deposits and it can be frozen and shipped, that's called LNG, liquefied natural gas. And the argument is that South Africa can receive the natural gas through a port, new port in Richards Bay, and also one in Matola. And that can go into power stations and can supply industry and also transport, among others. So it's very available. It gives the country absolute energy security, but there is a slightly higher price for those customers who previously relied on pipe gas.
Paul, let's talk about the financing of the overall gas infrastructure projects that we have in South Africa. We know that financing of any infrastructure projects are capital intensive at best, and that's putting it mildly, but especially when we look at these sorts of projects that have long-term useful lives that require long-term infrastructure financing. How does a bank like Standard Bank, that is the largest on the African continent, that specializes in ensuring that it's able to unlock new markets, how do you start to think about the financing of these gas projects on a long-term basis?
Well, from a big picture perspective, the country in SA has a lot of advantages. It has a very strong banking sector. We're part of it, but there are also other banks. So there is the money available to do that. And what we tend to do is we look at what's been done elsewhere in the world. We draw the lessons from it and we say, why can't this be done in South Africa? Or if it can be done, what needs to change and adapt? There's many markets around the world that have imported LNG for decades. Good examples, Japan, Korea, even markets that had extensive indigenous production are now importing LNG. Good example, UK, Indonesia come in. So ourselves and our banking peers are willing to support such projects. We can see the benefits for the country's energy security, the alleviation of load shedding, the balancing of the increase in renewable electricity. And it's really a question of just how do we sit together, how do we structure it and make it all work for 62 million South Africans.
Perhaps the energy mix conversation around South Africa does need to be broadened beyond what we would traditionally have had as conversations. And perhaps that's where the liquefied natural gas market steps into the conversation. We'll leave this conversation on that note. Gas sector lead at the Standard Bank Group, Paul Eardley-Taylor, joining us to take a look at the role of liquefied natural gas, the opportunity set it presents in South Africa, and how it is that we could potentially unlock that. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, the part of the show where we get to spotlight some really good South African businesses doing exceptionally well for themselves and hopefully showcase those businesses to you, the SAFM audience. This week's small business is in the e-hailing landscape, and I'm smiling if you can't hear that, because this is a proudly South African built business and it is a youth-led business. We're going to be speaking to the founder and CEO of a company called Bro Cabs. Percy Kamata joins me on the line now to get to know his business a little bit better and why it is that he built it. Percy, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about BroCabs. Why would you go into e-hailing and why would you go after a share of the pie of the big boys?
All right, thank you for having me. So why we went into the e-hailing space is because it's sort of like a calling. We had an experience with a lot of drivers because one of the co-founders worked in the rental space. He used to take a lot of trips with drivers who work in the e-hailing space. And the concern from them was the high commission rates and the fact that at the end of the month, after working the whole month and driving endless day in and day out, I can't even make ends meet with this model that currently exists. I don't have any other choice. There's no alternative. And there's no other solution. So I just have to bear with the brunt of the situation. And what we came with is a subscription model that would solve that problem for drivers.
So tell us about the business, Percy. Tell us about what it is that you built through BroCabs and how your business differs from what the other products might be in the market, from what other e-hailing products might be out there in the market.
So our app is called Bro. That's the Bro app. You can find it on all Play Stores, App Stores. It is a e-hailing app that takes people from one place to the next. You just request a ride and a driver comes and takes you to your destination. What makes us different is the fact that we charge a subscription to our drivers instead of taking commission from every single trip. What this means is that as a driver, you pay $600 a month to use the platform. And if you're making $20,000, $15,000, or even $2,000, we only take $600 and the rest is yours to keep in your pocket. On the rider side, we promise safety because we partnered with Safer City. And we also have good incentives for students, particularly. They have a segment called Bro Scholar on our platform that gives them discounted rates if they're a student. And we also have Data Free, which is also a segment that allows those students to have a experience of the app without having data on their cell phone.
So Percy, how then do you make your money? It sounds like you're offering a lot of benefit to the users of your platform. Have you left enough room for your business to be sustainable as a business? Because we definitely not want to see a business that is this good having to struggle through its own challenges. How are you guys managing your own business endeavors as a business that still needs to survive?
So how we make our money is through the subscription model. The drivers that pay that subscription every single month help support and make the business grow. But as you know, in this space, especially the startup and the e-hailing space, it takes about a decade to make a difference. So along the way, we have gotten one angel investor who has been helping us to get to this point where we are now in the market and working. But we are actively raising to have other partners who can help us get along to the end of this journey that we're trying to achieve. But in a nutshell, our revenue comes from the 600 subscriptions from drivers.
Percy, let's talk about the business and your growth plans. You touched on the fact that you're currently raising, but I want to take a look at perhaps how the market is shaping up. From a landscape perspective, the likes of Uber, the likes of Bolt, those are ideally your main competitors, I'd imagine, that are out there. We've seen other competitors come up in recent times as well in the e-hailing space. How do you see your competitive advantage in the e-hailing market compared to perhaps some of the other guys in the market at the moment?
Our competitive advantage is the fact that we're locally based, which means we understand our consumer and we understand our customer from a first-hand experience. I don't know how many calls I've done with drivers over the months, some of them in tears, that, look, I'm working so hard, man, and at the end of the day, it's hard to even put a meal on the table for the family. Our model introduces a solution where your revenue is predictable as a driver, your profit margins make sense. I mean, you have to service the car. You have to drive your kids to school as well with the same vehicle. There's also other maintenance costs of the vehicle. So our value add, which has worked in other markets outside of Africa, which is where we got inspiration for the model, it works, and it especially works in this industry that we're in with drivers who are fed up with the current ways that things are being done.
Percy, let's talk safety. Safety for drivers, safety for passengers. You touched on the fact that you do have existing partnerships that focus specifically on the safety aspects of it. We know that in the past we've had concerns both from a driver perspective as well as from a passenger perspective around some of the safety challenges that exist in the e-hailing landscape. How are you guys tackling that as a company?
So safety is a big concern, especially with the incidents that have been happening in the e-hailing space, hence the partnership with Safer City. Safer City introduces technology that helps us have safety measures on our app. One of the first in Africa, I think, and South Africa, is a first-time response on the panic buttons. So as a consumer of the application, once you press that panic button, you're prioritized, and a response unit can be sent to your trip. If
the business that is BroCabs, a business doing exceptionally well for themselves, all the best to you and your business, Percy. We love to see businesses like this that do all their bit to make South Africa a better place. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Founder and Chief Executive Officer at BroCabs, that is BROCABS.co.za. Percy Kamata joining us for this week's SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know this sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider. FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for today, folks. That's the update for the week. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Coast is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. From my side, good night.